Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Nathan Kelly, who's author of America's Inequality Trap. This was published in 2019 by University of Chicago Press. And Nate takes us through a really interesting and very clearly laid out discussion of the question of economic inequality and how that relates to politics. But I'm going to let Nate explain that to us. First, I'd like to welcome Nathan Kelly to the podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this project.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. I really am grateful for the opportunity to talk about the book a little bit. And like any book length project, the generation of this thing took a long time and was a lengthy process. I've been interested in income inequality, economic inequality, and politics for basically as long as I've been a political scientist. My dissertation was about income inequality and politics. My first book was, and I've just continued to work on related questions through my whole career. But this book specifically started out not as a book at all, but as a series of articles where I was exploring questions related to feedback, where a lot of my early work was about how politics affects inequality. I hadn't paid much attention at all to how inequality affects politics. And so I wrote a handful of articles and started to realize that a lot of the results in those articles sort of hung together and told a more unified story than maybe I realized before I started. And then I was attending a little conference at Yale that Veshla Weaver and Jacob Hacker put on up there. And as I was participating in those discussions, some more detailed ideas crystallized for me about how some of the various pieces of the political system and economic inequality might fit together. And I had a preliminary conversation with Larry Jacobs, who's the series editor at Chicago in American Politics, and talked through some ideas with him that I had. And he was very enthusiastic about the project from the start. And then things took off from there. And, a lot of hard work later, the book is finally in print. So it's been a fun process. And I think one that has produced some hopefully fruitful results that will spur others to dive in on some of these questions in the future as well.
And what you're talking about, and you really nicely lay this out in the book with diagrams and charts, is the connection between this question of economic inequality, politics, which includes partisanship, and sort of political dynamics among elected officials, and also policy. And so what I'd like is for you to sort of unpack the connection between these three areas that you started to do a little bit in terms of how inequality affects politics and how politics affects inequality.
Yeah. So in the book, I try to take a pretty sort of big picture take on how inequality and politics are related to each other. Of course, even with the big picture take that I take, there's a lot of things that I don't really address. For instance, I'm looking very specifically at economic inequality, and even within that, at income inequality. When it comes down to how I'm measuring and conceptualizing inequality. Now, of course, there are many other forms of inequality that may be even more important than economic inequality. Certainly, racial inequality overlaps with economic inequality, and that comes into the discussion somewhat in the book, but it isn't a clear emphasis. But I tried to think about various parts of the macro political system. So the American political system sort of writ large, and not limiting myself just to political institutions, not limiting myself just to political behavior, but kind of taking a broader view. And so sort of my training, most of my training is emphasizes public opinion. And so that's kind of where I start in the book. So I talk about how the mass public response to economic inequality. And I find that large portions of the population actually respond to inequality in ways that serve to further reinforce inequality through the political system. So when inequality rises, Democrats do worse at the polls, despite the fact that electing Democrats does tend to ameliorate inequality, at least to some extent. But the story doesn't just stop with political behavior and the mass public, but I also dive into some of the effects on the policy system and the structures and institutions of American politics as well. So I look at how Congress, in a context of partisan polarization and rising inequality, finds it very, very difficult to respond with new policy initiatives as inequality rises. And that lack of creation of new policy initiatives has the tendency to reinforce and exacerbate existing inequalities. And while policy inaction is part of the story that I look at, I also look at ways that policy action has happened in particularly narrow domains that actually reinforces inequality. So I look at financial deregulation specifically in the book, and find that as inequality has risen, Democrats have actually had some incentives to find common ground with Republicans on these issues of deregulation, and that the policies that are produced by these sort of limited bipartisan agreements are oftentimes and tend to be more inequality inducing than they are inequality ameliorating. So we have a system, both in terms of the behavior of the actors within the system, but also the way the institutions, in a sense, process economic inequality, that as time goes along serves to reinforce inequality, at least for the history that I analyzed.
And the title of your book, America's Inequality Trap, you go through, and this is not just, you know, sort of a title catching the eye of a reader. You go through and sort of discuss early on in the book what you mean by this concept of trap. And this goes to some of the points that you just made with regard to how the concentration of economic inequality, particularly based on income, kind of traps the system and doesn't allow, or sort of is very difficult to sort of move the system forward with regard to addressing income inequality. Can you talk about this concept of that trap?
Yeah, I mean, I think of the inequality trap, or a trap in general in this context, in a couple of different ways. And I think that the sort of traditional way to think about a trap is that something happens and then you're sort of stuck. So I think about, you know, the bear getting stuck in the classic, you know, metal trap in the forest that the hunter puts out and is immobilized and stuck. And there's a sense in which the inequality trap is like that, because when inequality is high, I find that there are lots of different ways that it's very challenging for the system to respond to that existing inequality. And so that inequality is unlikely to be undone through policy responses. And so in that sense, we face sort of a traditional trap. But another way that I think about the trap is a sort of less traditional trap. And it's more like a black hole, in the sense that once you start moving in a particular direction, there are reinforcing effects that actually exacerbate the problem. So not only is the system sort of reinforcing existing inequality and keeping it the same, but in some senses, actually, the system responds in ways that once inequality is going in a particular direction, it's going to keep it going in that direction for a while. And that's one of the reasons that I think we've seen these very, very long runs of rising and falling inequality over time. So we've been essentially 40 years in to a steady increase in income concentration in the United States. And part of the reason for that is that we have these trap, but also black hole type effects where we just get sucked toward more and more income concentration. And the political system is an important aspect of generating that type of trap.
And so in terms of that sort of, you graph it out so beautifully in the book, that there was the income inequality that trajected upwards prior to the Great Depression. And then there was, sort of a downward slope, and then there was a trajectory upwards. And so you've graphed it over, 100 years now. That what are the ways that you saw with regard to how that became such a dynamic?
Yeah, and I think one of the sort of puzzles that I encountered in the book that's an obvious puzzle. If you just look at that that classic chart of top income shares, really a great measure of income concentration over time that is available over this more than 100-year period at this point. Inequality by that measure was very, very high prior to the Great Depression. But then the path of that variable changed, and we saw declines in inequality for decades and decades until the 1970s, when things reversed again and headed the other direction. And we're now in a situation where inequality is just as high as it was in the sort of roaring 20s. And so one of the puzzles is that why in the 1920s and 1930s, was there a response that was generated that reduced inequality so much? And why, when we're in the same context and we have a major crisis in 2007 and 2008, that we don't see the same kind of policy response, even though inequality was similarly high? And one of the things that I sort of point to, and this is not a solid conclusion in the book, but one thing that I kind of discuss and needs more exploration, is that income concentration in the 20s and 30s was actually not so focused on concentration at the top in a few hands as we sometimes tend to think that it was. Right now, we have income concentration where all of the concentration in income is really happening at the top of the income distribution. But in the 20s and 30s, there was a lot more inequality in the middle. So sort of normal people were probably a lot more capable of seeing and experiencing inequality than they are today. And this seems to have some potential consequences for the extent to which inequality actually becomes reinforcing through the political system. And so I think that's an interesting part potentially of the story.
You're talking about why we have a different form of income concentration right now versus the kind of income concentration that preceded the Great Depression. And the part of what you're discussing is the experience that people have with regard to who has that wealth. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And really how many people have that wealth. And, right now, money is much more in the hands of a small group of people. I mean, it's not even the top 1% where we see income concentration happening at such an extreme level. It's really the top 1% of the top 1%. So you're talking about a very, very rarefied group. A pretty insulated group that people don't necessarily see, although people are cognizant of rising inequality, and even when they are cognizant of it, they don't necessarily respond the way we might expect them to. And I think part of that is that the kind of inequality that they really see isn't the kind of inequality that is actually present in the current system, where it's so concentrated at the very, very tip top.
And so you and I say don't necessarily interact with people who have that sort of very high concentration of wealth. like 99% of Americans don't necessarily interact with them.
That's yeah, that's right.
And so that we know it exists, but we don't sort of have an understanding of how it impacts us per se, because we're not necessarily in sort of a dynamic with people who have that kind of wealth. But one of the points that you make in the book, and one of the points that you have also articulated, is that that there's a connection between the sort of policy pursuits around income inequality and the parties themselves that sort of may be counterintuitive, shall we say. Can you talk a little bit about, as you sort of noted, that when inequality rises, Democrats tend to do worse in the polls, at least in the 20th century?
Right. And so that's the thing. I mean, we sort of expect a democratic system to, in some sense, act kind of like a thermostat or a braking system, where if things go too far in one direction or the other, we kind of think, oh, well, the people will respond in the opposite direction and will elect leaders who are making different decisions that will ameliorate the problem. And we just don't see that with regard to public opinion or elections and how they respond to rising inequality. And the thing that I think probably the key thing that I found in the book that I think is interesting, and others have found using different kinds of analysis, sort of similar findings that are supportive of each other. There's a very, very strong interaction between racism, racial animus, whatever term you want to apply to it, and economic inequality. So what I found is that for the subset of people who have a lot of racial animus, they respond to rising inequality by becoming less supportive of redistribution. And so that undermines the sort of thermostatic response that we might typically expect to see. And of course, politicians are very adept at taking advantage of the openings that rising inequality presents to capitalize on racial divisions. I mean, we've certainly seen that in the very recent past in the United States. So the patterns that are in the book are sort of like showing up in the headlines all the time right now, where we see racial animus and economic inequality being used to reinforce each other electorally. Now, the legs on that might be running out, but it's something that has been common in the past and continues to be common now.
And so not only do we see that, but, you know, this was kind of a trope of the coverage of 2016, economic anxiety among particularly white voters, and how that translated to support for Donald Trump. And so you're talking about essentially people who are not necessarily the most wealthy or elite, but are then sort of advocating for policies that are going to be ones that favor the most wealthy or elite, even if they are not themselves those people. Is that correct?
Yes, partially. I mean, I think that it's important to note that, you know, when we look at the cross-sectional evidence, that people who are who have less income they do tend to be more supportive than rich people of redistribution. But what's important to note is that over time, as inequality increases, those folks actually become less distinct from rich people in terms of their support for redistribution. And so it undermines the thermostatic effect. So, I mean, I do want to be clear about that. But yeah, we see this overlap of economic anxiety and racism. And that's where, you know, I think that a lot of the discussion about the 2016 election has been focused on, is it economic anxiety or is it racism that drove the result? And I think those are useful discussions to have to try to figure out sort of which factor is primary. But I think ultimately the big picture answer is, if you want to know whether it was economic anxiety or racism that generated 2016 outcomes? The answer is yes. It was both. they worked in tandem. I think that's the important takeaway.
And that was one of the points that I found you tracing throughout the book, that was like, oh, it's not one or the other. It's both, that came together in this interesting way as you're sort of, pushing through the research. So I wanted to ask a little bit more about the sort of policymaking process, and how income inequality, and particularly the rising income inequality, shapes that process in a way that sort of triggers this or sort of makes the trap a little bit more static.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that we have to keep in mind at the outset is just that when something is happening in the policy space, when there's a problem that needs to be solved, action needs to be taken for it to be solved. And so when inaction occurs, the status quo will be reinforced. So as inequality rises, action has to happen in order to undo that rising inequality. But as it turns out, it becomes more of a challenge in the context of rising inequality to produce policy. And I mean, and this finding goes, you know, back to McCarty, Poole, and Rosenthal's book, Polarized America, where they found this interesting linkage and dance between party polarization and income inequality. I look specifically not just at polarization, but actually how much policy is produced in the American policy system, and find that there is, in fact, less policy made when inequality rises. And when you have policy not being made in the context of rising inequality, that is going to produce this trap-like situation.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so there's the question of policy that is not made, as it were, to change the inequality situation, so that you know, as you say, less policy is made when there is higher income inequality. But there's also the flip side of that, that you look at towards the end of the book, where policies are made that exacerbate income inequality,
right.
Which is the flip of that. So what is the context for that?
Yeah. Every once in a while, I get a question like, well, how can you kind of have it both ways? I thought the story is that policy isn't made. And now you're saying that policy action also is part of this inequality trap. How can that possibly be? And, you know, I want to be clear that the main story is that inequality makes it harder to make policy. So the big, you know, the big item is that there's a trap created because policy just generally isn't made very in very large amounts when inequality is high. But policymakers are still working to do stuff even when it's really hard to make policy. And as it turns out, those areas where compromises can be found tend to be the places where inequality would be exacerbated. So it became easier to sell Democrats on financial deregulation as inequality was higher, in part because their constituents needed access to credit in order to sort of keep things afloat. And so while the deregulation effort had been ongoing for years with Republicans leading the charge, they still needed some agreement from Democrats in order to make it happen. It's not like Democrats, 100% supported deregulation. That's not the case at all. But Republicans were able to peel off more effectively a small number of Democrats to support financial deregulation when inequality was high and some Democratic constituents were in need of access to credit that the deregulators could say would start to flow more readily if financial deregulation happened. So that was part of it. And then, of course, there were, those in the Democratic Party that sort of had ideational leanings toward a more free market orientation. And that obviously helped the situation as well. But some of that can also likely be traced back to rising inequality and some of the electoral incentives that it creates, even for Democrats.
So on all of these happy notes, and we have this really high concentration of income inequality that we're facing these days in the midst of a global pandemic, an economic downturn, a rising deficit, all of those things. What's the solution, Nate?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. And, there's clearly not a solution. One of the stories I think of the book is that to get things moving in a different direction requires coordinated action on a lot of fronts. So you need policy responses that will push against rising inequality, but it's harder to get those policy actions in the context of high inequality. But that doesn't mean it can't happen. When the balance of political power shifts, it means that those who are more favorable toward egalitarian outcomes, frankly, we're talking about, it's a partisan thing. It's Democrats that are going to be doing that. They need to prioritize those new kinds of policies and policies that that reverse the trend toward more inequality would have electoral benefits for Democrats down the road as well. So while the inequality trap is depressing in a lot of ways for those who are more progressive and more egalitarian in their desires, at the same time, the fact that the inequality trap exists and there are so many parts to it means that there are a lot of targets for action as well. So I don't think there's any sort of like, well, okay, here's the clear path of how we get out of it. But what we see happening now with social movements, with white people in pretty small places in rural America, at least symbolically supporting efforts like Black Lives Matter, it suggests that there may be some change afoot. Change is going to be hard. And I would advise those who want to see these changes happen that they really do need to pay very careful attention to institutional reforms that can be self-reinforcing. So making sure that it's not just about passing the favorite policy in the moment, but it's also about changing the structures of how policy is made in order to make it easier for those things to happen in the future. One of the first things that I would recommend is doing away with the filibuster. And that's actually starting to be discussed, I think, more broadly and more publicly now. And that's something that Democrats ought to get on board with if they're concerned about these things. And it's the kind of thing that activists need to argue hard for so that the structures that exist now can be shifted in ways that may make the trap of inequality harder to sustain.
So the filibuster, which allows you to hold up legislation in the Senate, why would getting rid of the filibuster necessarily change the dynamics around this particular sort of situation?
Yeah. So, I don't think that any one institutional reform is going to solve all the problems by any stretch. And I think that a lot of the issues that are present would be, present with the filibuster gone or not. But the filibuster is one of the key institutions that exist in American politics that leads to status quo bias and makes it hard for policy to pass. You can have massive support in the public and even in the Senate for a policy reform. And when you need 60 votes, which is what the filibuster essentially requires, a supermajority, it makes it a lot more difficult to get policy made. And so when a problem exists that requires policy action, having that veto point in place that requires a supermajority causes major problems in terms of achieving policy change. So obviously there would be, you know, there can be backlash effects too. I mean, if the filibuster is gone, then when the other side gets power, they can make changes more quickly as well. But the broad story of American history is that when policy changes, on average, it shifts in a progressive direction. So, and in an egalitarian direction. So those who are supportive of progressive policies would do well to sort of get past their fear of what the other side might do in the absence of filibuster and support that reform.
And the Madisonian system as it's set up is one that by its very nature kind of favors policy inaction, I would suggest, because of the sort of separation of powers and the difficulty of getting legislation passed. Filibuster or no filibuster. But you're not necessarily recommending that we throw out the Madisonian system, are you?
No, I mean, I guess I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily going that far. Others have and have made those arguments. With or without the filibuster, policymaking is going to be slow. Policymaking is going to require a lot of consensus in the U.S. system. So I don't think people have to worry about like these, you know, if they're worried about wild changes happening, getting rid of the filibuster isn't going to cause that to happen. But, you know, I think that we do have a system that is very much biased towards stasis, and we have a structure that doesn't work very well in such a consensual set of institutions. I mean, when we have party polarization on the scale that we have now, it is so hard to gain the sufficient consensus that's required to pass policy, that we just sort of have a mismatch between our political and policymaking institutions and our partisan distribution of preferences. So while I'm not ready to sort of latch onto, yeah, let's just dump the Senate completely, I'm not impossible to persuade on that point.
So we would have the House and not necessarily the Senate, which, you know, there are lots of questions about the voice of the people in the Senate versus the House, of course. Yeah. I wanted to ask you a question that sort of came up a little bit as you were talking about how you got into this research, that you've always been a scholar of inequality and inequality in politics. But I'm wondering, as you went through this research, and as you say, it started out as a number of articles and built towards a book, was there anything particularly surprising in your findings that you didn't expect?
Well, I mean, I did not expect to see the differential response to rising inequality in the public that was exactly the way it turned out to be. That poor people were more likely to respond to rising inequality by becoming essentially more conservative on economic issues was surprising to me. And diving into the notion that race and racism was an important aspect there sort of explained the surprise a bit. But when I first saw that, I was pretty stunned. I remember the first days when I was doing some of the analysis where I was breaking down the response to rising inequality by income group. I created some charts that maybe made it into the book, but maybe didn't. But I remember sharing them on Twitter and saying, these are some of the most surprising and interesting results I've ever seen. Here's what I'm finding. And other people were also surprised. And it was encouraging to see that the initial results were as shocking as they turned out to be.
And does this follow on some of the other research you note in the book, referencing Kathy Kramer's work? But I'm even thinking back to the sort of popular book about 15, 20 years ago by Thomas Franks, What's the Matter with Kansas? And it seems to be sort of tying in with some of our understanding or thinking about sort of white rural populations in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it dovetails really, really nicely with Kathy Kramer's work, which is just amazing. I mean, what she's done is so enlightening, and has had already such an important impact. And, you know, I'm obviously taking a very different approach in terms of my analysis. It's totally, almost totally quantitative, whereas Kathy Kramer's work is very deeply qualitative and really interacts with people on a very personal level. But I think that the results that I find quantitatively really, really reinforce a lot of the findings that she has. And I think one of the things that it sort of points to, both her work and my work, even if I didn't really explicitly discuss it, is just sort of the way that people actually think about inequality is definitely not the way that academics tend to think about inequality. I mean, economists, political scientists, sociologists, when we talk about inequality, we talk about Gini coefficients and top 1% shares, and we use the term inequality a lot, and basically people don't use those kinds of terms a lot. They're typically making very specific comparisons. They're thinking about how they are different than others, and they think about how they are different and the same from others in their social circle or in their town. And they aren't necessarily thinking about those, you know, multi-billionaires that exist someplace else. And if they do have some interaction with a millionaire or a billionaire in their town, a lot of times that interaction is very carefully managed by the wealthier individual who comes in and tries to make sure that everyone sees that actually they're just like the middle income and poorer people in the town, and they do a lot of good things for the town. And it sort of this may be too strong of a term, but it kind of manipulates people in a sense. And so I think it's, you know, it's fascinating to think more carefully about how people really experience economic disparities of various types. And I think there are a number of scholars who are starting to do that. In addition to, you know, Kathy Kramer's important work, I think there are others are diving in even more specifically to some of these questions about the experiences of economic inequality and how people really talk about it and how people really come into contact or don't with it in their lived experience.
Yeah, I think some colleagues of mine actually are working on a book from the University of Chicago on this right now. Amber Wachowski and her co-author, have a book. Yes.
Yes, they've got a book coming out, and it's an excellent one. I've seen it, and it is, they make some really powerful arguments and some really useful findings about how it is that people really do think about inequality. And it's very rigorous as well. So that's one to look out for. It may even already be out. I'm not sure.
Not quite out yet, but okay. Soon.
Yeah. People can look out for it. It's a good one.
Yeah, it's on my list. So Nate, what are you working on now?
So I've got another book project in the works with co-authors that we're actually close to finishing up. It actually dovetails quite nicely with the Inequality Trap book. It's called Hijacking the Congressional Agenda. And what we focus on in that book is what members of Congress are talking about. We're particularly interested in the extent to which they talk about issues that are of particular interest to upper income individuals, as opposed to issues that are more important to middle income and lower income Americans. And we explore ways that people with money can influence that process and influence what gets attended to and what doesn't. It's a mixed methods book. We do some quantitative text analysis in addition to some detailed case studies of various policymaking processes. And one of the core quantitative findings that we have is that even if you just focus on campaign contributions, which is maybe the sort of tip of the iceberg about how wealthy individuals and corporations would influence the political process, there's a very direct relationship between money received from interests and what members of Congress talk about and what they pay attention to in terms of the policy space. So we find some very, very clear effects of money on the policy agenda. And you know, I think that there are more and more studies that are finding explicit effects of money on politics, but we focus on the agenda setting stage of the process and find that money has has important effects there. So it's a it's under review right now, and hopefully we'll have a home for it soon.
Well, I hope you'll come and talk to me about that with your co-authors when it comes out.
We sure will. We would love to do that. It's an exciting project.
That'd be great. Well, I want to thank Nathan Kelly for joining me today to talk about America's Inequality Trap. This is published by University of Chicago Press in 2019, I think is the copyright date. And I'm sure it can be purchased at the University of Chicago Press website. Is there a brick and mortar store online that you would like to shout out, Nate?
Well, you know, I love Union Avenue Books in downtown Knoxville, and they're a terrific outfit.
Great. So thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.